Explore the night skies with our large range of high-quality telescopes. Whether you're a novice or an astronomy expert, we have the right telescope for you in our Australian Geographic e-store. Explore the whole range and find the right telescope for you today. Go to australiangeographic.com.au/shop. That's australiangeographic.com.au/shop. Hi, I'm Chrissy Goldrick and this is Talking Australia, a podcast by Australian Geographic. Today I'm joined by Dr. Dean Miller. Dr. Dean Miller is a marine biologist, an adventurer, a filmmaker, a photographer and a writer, and he's had many articles in Australian Geographic. He also hosted the AG documentary series Australian Geographic Explores. Today, Dean is Managing Director of Great Barrier Reef Legacy, a non-profit organisation dedicated to the conservation of coral reefs around the world, and with particular focus on our own Great Barrier Reef. It gives me great pleasure to welcome Dean Miller to Talking Australia. Well, it's a bit of a strange one, really, because as our listeners would know, we normally record our podcasts in the podcast studio at Australian Geographic, otherwise known as the stationery cupboard. But because of COVID-19, we're all working from home. So this is one of our first podcasts that we've done where we're all recording in different parts of the country. So we're sort of nailing the technology to be able to bring you a podcast from all where we're all in different parts of Australia. So we're in new territory. So we're going to see how we go. But so far, so good, Dean.
Well, I feel honoured, and just to let you know, I am looking at the Great Barrier Reef right now. So, look, it's right on topic.
Well, that's great because that sort of means it's a sort of a live podcast from the place that we're going to be talking about. Although I have to say my view in Sydney is a little bit different. It is my own backyard, which is as it is these days. But anyway, whilst the epidemic and the pandemic rolls on, the environmental issues that afflict our planet also roll on in the way that they have been doing. So a coral bleaching event after only 2 years after the last major one is very disappointing. So, Dean, what do you know about this event that's unfolding at the moment?
Yeah, look, we've been keeping a pretty close eye on things. I think we all know that this has been a really, really hot summer. I think we've experienced not only very hot days in our own homes and backyards, but have seen what's been happening with the forest fires. And the same thing has really been happening underwater up here on the Great Barrier Reef. It's been very hot conditions, clear, sunny days, perfect conditions for bleaching, really, and no real, I guess, wind to mix up the water and kind of, you know, get that temperature really hovering around, you know, a reasonable degrees Celsius to ensure that corals will survive. So what they've done is really experienced a warm water situation, which mm-hmm. really stresses them out. And then on top of that, they're getting lots of UV, direct UV sunlight, which kind of acts like a bit of a sunburn, really. So what we're seeing is a lot of shallow corals being affected, mainly in the inshore and mid-shelf sort of sections. But outer reef is also partially affected too. So Terry Hughes from James Cook University has been doing aerial surveys over the last couple of weeks, and they've reported that, yes, this is another mass bleaching event now, the third in 5 years, as you mentioned. We were up around the Lizard Island area and the Ribbon Reef area, which is kind of north of Cooktown, diving up around there, and we saw bleaching at virtually every site that we went to. It was much worse on the inshore sites as was, you know, sort of predicted. But out on the outer reef, it you know, was happening out there too, even down to sort of 16 meters. So again, it's been a really hot summer. The water temperature's been about 2 degrees above average. And, you know, the really interesting thing about corals is that they just can't get up and move away. They have to stay there. And when that warm water comes along, it really does provide a stress moment for them. And, you know, it's not just a couple of days, it's weeks on end. So, yeah, really disappointing to see the third mass bleaching event in 5 years. The question, you know, that we have to really ask ourselves is how many bleaching events can the corals make it through? Where's the tipping point here? Mm. And, you know, that's a real, you know, serious and interesting question for managers and scientists and even, you know, the general public. You know, this is our Great Barrier Reef. You know, is it going to be okay? That's the question here.
Well, I guess what's happening is, I mean, when corals bleach, and you might want to explain a little bit about what leads to the bleaching, what that process is. It can be a temporary situation, and the coral can actually get its colour back again if the water temperatures cool down. But I think what we've seen is, and what we know about corals is, if they don't get time to recover, then it can kill the coral off altogether. Isn't that right?
Absolutely. So, yeah, let's have a little chat about bleaching. So basically, it's as I said before, both warm water and UV stress. So if the water temperature is too warm for too long, basically the coral is it has a symbiotic relationship. The coral is an animal, and in its tissue, it has algae and bacteria. And the algae provides about 95% of its food source by producing sugar. So it's like you or I having leaves under our skin and basically just standing out in the sun and getting all the food that we need, which is, you know, that'd be pretty handy. I guess when the warm temperatures come along. So the water temperature is too warm, the algae within the tissue starts to create a toxin, and the coral has really no choice but to get rid of the algae to stop making that toxin, and basically says, look, you're a bad roommate, I'm sick of what you're doing to me, and it ejects the algae. And in doing that, it gets rid of 95% of its food source. Corals are an animal, they're like a little jellyfish really, so they've got polyps, and they're able to still feed by taking small microscopic organisms and plant material out of the water column, so they can still survive during these bleaching events. And it's called coral bleaching, really, because the algae's now gone out of the tissue, and the algae gives the coral all of its colour. So the pinks, the blues, the browns, the purples, all the beautiful colours that you see in either brochures, documentaries, or if you've been lucky enough to visit our Great Barrier Reef, you will have seen them firsthand. So when that algae's gone, the tissue of the coral is really only very thin, and it's sitting on top of a calcium carbonate skeleton, much like the bones in our own bodies. And they're, as you can imagine, stark white. So that's why it's called bleaching, because you can see straight through the tissue and you can see the skeleton underneath. As you mentioned, if the temperature drops, the coral can survive. So bleaching is not a death sentence in itself. It's very much a stress event. It's like, you know, having a fever. And when that fever breaks, you return mostly back to normal. But if you can't break that fever, then, you know, theoretically, the corals will die, and that's when we see mass coral mortality. So there really is, you know, two sides of this story. So the bleaching can happen because of a heat stress event and also UV. If that stress event goes away, then the corals can recover. However, they're, you know, somewhat impaired in the coming years for spawning events, for instance. Or if the temperature stays too warm for too long, then that's when we see corals die. And that's what we saw in 2016, 2017, is really just water too hot for too long, and we saw mass mortality. We don't seem to be seeing that this season. So thankfully we had a fairly good couple of weeks of bad weather up here, which meant windy, cool conditions, dropping the water temperature, and most importantly, really taking away that UV stress. So as you can imagine, just sitting on a beach or out in the open for days and weeks and months on end in direct sunlight, that's just too hot, too powerful, it's going to take its toll. So hopefully there's not the big mortality event that we experienced in 16, 17 this year.
And yeah, but it's still probably too early to call that, as we are now towards the end of March, isn't it, Dean?
Especially we've got to get out there and get underwater and have a bit of a look around. As you can imagine, with COVID, that's really difficult. Boats aren't running, and you can't get outside and do those things, which is a really testing time for, I think, scientists, the marine scientists, wanting to know what's happening with the Great Barrier Reef. But look, here's hoping, it's spared for this summer. But as again, we've got to come back to the question, how many summers can we last? And the thing about corals is that we're asking the corals to do an extraordinary thing within a lifetime. And that's because corals can live for hundreds, if not thousands of years. So, you know, we've bumped up the temperature in the last couple of hundred years through burning of fossil fuels in the Industrial Revolution and you know, up until now. And, you know, that kind of temperature increase has usually happened over thousands of years. We're asking the corals to do it in their single lifetime. And that's where the tricky sort of scenario comes in. So, you know, they haven't had generations and generations to adapt to this, you know, new kind of heat wave. They're really just being asked to do it now.
Yeah. And do you think, I mean, the Great Barrier Reef, if we think about it, it's 2,300 kilometers long, something like this, the most enormous thing to try and research, you know, this is such a huge area, and obviously it's offshore, so accessibility is an issue. Do you think that somewhere out there in the Great Barrier Reef there would be areas that are perhaps not as susceptible as others? Do you think that there are any areas that may actually be building any resistance at all to these major, the coral bleaching and the warming temperatures of the ocean?
Absolutely, yeah. And that's a real kind of saving grace for the Great Barrier Reef. As you said, it's a very big area. I think it's 144,000 square kilometres. Don't quote me on that. Maybe 344. I can't remember exactly.
Yes, it's big, all right? What we know is it's big. These numbers are almost meaningless because we need something to compare it to. But certainly you could fly over it for quite a few hours.
Yeah, I think it's the same size as... Same size as Italy, I think they keep referring it to. Look, it is big. There are 3,000 individual reefs. And if you can try to imagine, if you took the water away, what that would look like as a geographical structure. It's kind of like, you know, a big sort of open plain with lots of hills and mounds and long sort of expanses of substrate. And so now throw the water back on top of that and throw tides and currents and things like that. And you're going to get extraordinary amounts of water movement that's really hard to predict. Now, when you get that water movement, you get changing in temperature. Alongside the Great Barrier Reef is the Coral Sea. That's, you know, 2,000 odd meters, you know, within probably a kilometer or two of the edge of the Great Barrier Reef. And there's lots of nice cool water down there. Yeah. So that's why we see on the outer Great Barrier Reef, they tend to be a lot more protected than, say, the inshore and the mid-shelf, because the inshore and the mid-shelf, you know, tend to live in sort of shallow, turbid water areas that heat they're much quicker.
And they're affected by a lot more things than just the heating of the water as well, aren't they? Much more sort of human impacts directly off the land.
Yeah, absolutely. So, look, you know, before 2016 came along, we thought the Great Barrier Reef was just too big to fail, and we were really concentrating on things like water quality, crown of thorns starfish, you know, fertilizers going into the water, that kind of thing. But 2016 came along and showed us that no, you know, this can really affect a big expanse of the Great Barrier Reef, and very, very quickly. And the one part that was affected the most was the far northern Great Barrier Reef, and that was the most pristine part of the reef that we had. So from, say, Port Douglas to Cape York, is where that far northern section is. There's really no massive population centers. There's no, you know, huge farming. There's no river outputs that would take farming effluent away onto the Great Barrier Reef itself. It was the best reef that we knew, and that's the part that bleached the most. So the take-home story there is, you know, you can do everything you want to reduce water quality and crown of thorns and all those other things. And look, we should still keep on doing that. But when bleaching, or when, you know, warm water comes along, there's no escape. And so we've got to address both things equally. And I think that's what we're not seeing. We're seeing a lot of on the ground activity and, you know, sort of addressing, you know, water quality and crown of thorns starfish. Yep, that's great. Absolutely. Let's try to build up the resilience of the natural system. But we've got to address the major problem, the elephant in the room, which is climate change.
We'll be back with our conversation with Dr. Dean Miller after a quick break.
Subscribe to our AG magazine for 6 months for just $30 and save 33% on the newsstand price. That's three issues of our award-winning magazine delivered to your home for just $30. Plus, you will also receive exclusive benefits, including 10% off all products purchased in our e-store. So don't wait. Go to www.australiangeographic.com.au /talkingaustralia for our special offer. That's www.australiangeographic.com.au/talkingaustralia.
You have sort of dedicated your life in recent years to this through the organisation Great Barrier Reef Legacy, which I mentioned earlier. Tell us a little bit about that organisation, what role it plays in sort of bringing, I suppose, the problems that beset the reef to a much larger audience and communicating, which are sort of quite complicated ideas, to the biggest possible audience. How do you do that, Dean?
Yeah, look, it's a great question. I think the whole reason Great Barrier Reef Legacy was created in the first place is because there was a group of really passionate marine scientists, educators, tourism operators, multimedia professionals. Our group or our team really sort of, you know, realized that if we got together, we could start doing really good things and really quickly. And being nonprofit means that we can cut through the red tape and just get stuff done on the ground. And that's kind of where Great Barrier Reef Legacy started. It's saying, okay, we can do things very cost effectively and we can do things very, very quickly. And by doing that, we can make a big difference. And so the three things that we really sort of concentrate on is research. We understand that we need to work out what's going on in the natural system to understand the problems and then to try to find the solutions. And up until now, there's really only been one research vessel by the Australian Institute of Marine Science out there doing its thing. Scientists have very limited capacity to access the reef. And so we were trying to overcome that. And we've run over five collaborative expeditions for researchers all around the world now. So part of getting the researchers out there is part of solving that problem. The other one is education. We realize that we need to get the next generation up to speed as quickly as possible to kind of hand the baton over and get them, you know, running with this as soon as they can. And so education's a major component of what we do, both in Australia and overseas. And we really love that. Working with the kids is just the most fantastic thing. And we've got some great partners and collaborators there. And the final one is really communication. So communicating with a global audience why it's important to try to save coral reefs. And, you know, for someone in maybe Melbourne or Sydney, that might not make much sense. But, you know, coral reefs contribute, I guess, a major life history step for over 25% of the ocean's marine life, which is really, really important. And, you know, is super important to hundreds of millions of people around the world in the equatorial zone. So, you know, we lose coral reefs, we lose a major part of our oceans, but also it's going to have a huge social impact on the world, much bigger than what we're seeing right now with COVID-19. And so those three things in unison really allow us to, A, get the research out there to the students and the next generation, and then communicate everything with a global audience. So we're all on the same team. You know, this is a global problem which requires a global solution. So we better start playing as a big team. So that's really where Great Barrier Reef Legacy evolved from. And since 2012, which is when we started, we launched in 2016, and we've run, as I said, five major research, education, and multimedia expeditions now for a range of different reasons. The first one was to go up into the far north and find out what had happened underwater after the 2016 bleaching event. Again, we sort of, you know, we'd had the aerial surveys, but no one had really got underwater and worked out what had happened. So we took a team up there of experts from Australia and around the world, and we searched for the super corals, the ones that had survived. And that was a really important sort of component. We knew that corals had really been impacted, but where were the survivors? You know, who were they, and where did they exist? And that's coming back to sort of your question about, you know, are there spots that are really good still? And the answer is yes.
And you did on that expedition, I think that was that in around November in 2018 that you went up there, you did actually discover a very large area of reef that was untouched.
Yeah.
It's what you called a super site.
Yeah, we called it the Legacy Super Site, or Dr. Charlie Verrin called it the Legacy Super Site. We found it in 2016 actually with our team, and we'd sort of been just diving around looking for really, you know, where corals had survived, and happened upon this spot. And it's about 200 or 300 meters long by about 30 or 40 meters wide. So it's a small section of a larger reef, and it was absolutely phenomenal. And Dr. Charlie Verrin, who's also known as the godfather of corals, he's, you know, spent his entire life researching, describing and naming corals, got out of the water, and, you know, he'd sort of, you know, almost given up hope on the Great Barrier Reef. And then we found this site, and it had over 205 species of corals in one section. Now, to put that in perspective, there's about 400 species on the Great Barrier Reef. So this one site represented over half of all the known corals that we knew on the entire Great Barrier Reef. So it was nature's biobank, really. You know, it was an absolute hotspot of biodiversity amidst this kind of, you know, desert of devastation.
Topography or just luck or what was it?
I think it's a combination of all those things. And look, we've had a few researchers look into it and try to work out exactly what's happening. And you can only really infer, you know, you can't get to the absolute nitty-gritty, but yes, it's right on the outer edge of the Great Barrier Reef, so it's got that cold water influence. It's kind of in a back eddy situation, so it doesn't seem to, be affected so much by all the warm water that's coming off the Great Barrier Reef Lagoon on an outgoing tide. And why it's got this absolute biodiversity, we still don't quite understand, because we never found another site like it, even within, you know, just kilometers of that area. So there's something about that particular site where, you know, lots of currents from lots of different places kind of end up there, and the energy kind of drops out, and that's, you know, perhaps where the spawn settles. Very luckily. It's an amazing place. However, in November last year, we went up looking around, because we knew that Cyclone Trevor had been up around that area and gone straight over the Legacy Supersite. So we're a bit worried. And on our expedition last year, searching for biodiversity, we actually, well, it was a really tough trip, because we spent 2 weeks trying to get outside of the cyclone damage. And so there was cyclone damage from Princess Charlotte Bay to about Rain Island, which is about a 100-mile stretch. And unfortunately, the Legacy Supersite was a victim of that you know, severe weather event. And so, you know, theoretically, that biodiversity has been somewhat lost. The site doesn't resemble anything that it used to. It kind of looks like it's been sandblasted.
Right. It was smashed, was it, by the cyclone?
Yeah, really disappointing. So we spent the rest of our expedition trying to look for other areas of biodiversity, and thankfully Dr. Charlie Verrin did it again, and he found a site that had 267 species of coral. So yeah. Look, those spots are out there, you know, they're the absolute, you know, necessity for reseeding the reef. And that's what really needs to happen. We need to have these kind of little nursery areas that at least have the capacity and the resilience to get through these heat stress events that allow kind of the spawning and the reseeding of the areas around them. So they're hugely important, these little hotspots.
And tell us a little bit, was it the discovery of that super site in the first place and obviously ongoing research that led you to found the Coral Biobank? Do you want to tell us a little bit about that initiative that GBR Absolutely. Legacy is now involved in?
Yeah, no problems. So we've just launched a project called the Living Coral Biobank Project. And basically what we're trying to do is collect all living specimens of all species from the Great Barrier Reef and then around the world. So there's 400 species of corals from the Great Barrier Reef, and there's 800 species of hard corals from around the world. And what we plan to do is build a special holding facility here in Port Douglas and basically house living fragments of those corals. And the really interesting thing about corals is that they are one of the only animals or organisms out there that kind of can live in perpetuity. As I said earlier, you know, corals can be up to 100 or hundreds of years, if not thousands of years. So they have this ability to just keep living, which is really, really extraordinary, but makes them a perfect candidate for a living coral biobank. So like the seed banks that we have around the world where we've collected genetic material, it's exactly the same scenario, except that we're going to keep living fragments alive. And There's one really important reason for that, and that's because corals have this symbiotic relationship with the algae and the bacteria within their tissue. So not only are we keeping the corals alive and that genetic material, but also their symbiotic partners. And they're the really important ones because they're the ones that are kind of deciding the fate of corals right now, because they're the ones that are affected by the heat stress events. We've hooked up with a partner called Cairns Marine up here in Cairns, who's an absolute world leader in coral husbandry and transport, and they're going to help us collect the corals and keep them alive. We've also partnered with Dr. Charlie Varon. He's going to be doing all the underwater identification. And really the plan is to go and collect many representatives of each of the species of corals on the Great Barrier Reef and keep them alive. So we know that the corals in the far north are the ones that are doing it the toughest, and that's where we're going to concentrate our collections first. Because with each bleaching event, what we're doing is losing the most vulnerable corals. And that's something that no researchers are really focusing on. No one's out there kind of working out which ones were, you know, we're losing, which ones are disappearing with these heat stress events. We kind of always...
You think that some of them might disappear before we even know what they are?
Yeah, there's a possibility. In 2016, Charlie discovered one, if not three, new species of corals at that legacy supersite. So there's, you know, thousands and you know, well, the ability for us to know everything on coral reefs is, you know, impossible. So, you know, we don't even know what we're losing. And I think, you know, we always talk about corals, but we never... take into consideration that you can't have a coral reef without coral, right? So they're the kind of the foundation or the building blocks of this amazing, incredible ecosystems, you know, some of the most biodiverse communities on the planet with, you know, hundreds of thousands of different individual animals representing thousands of different species, you know, in 10 square meters. You know, we're losing that, and that's really what it comes down to. The coral is the habitat. It's the food source. It's the hiding spots. It's everything that a coral reef needs.
And it's just the beginning, isn't it? I mean, because, well, yeah. We think of the coral and we think, you know, and I even think that not everyone really understands that coral is a living creature. It's an animal.
Yeah.
The coral is just the start, but then so many different species rely on that coral. So many fish and so many marine creatures are also part of that ecosystem. So if we lose the coral, we lose so much more.
Absolutely. And look, there's a real kind of tipping point here. And as soon as we lose a certain amount of biodiversity of those corals, we're going to start losing ecosystem function. And I think that's, you know, probably the worst thing that we can experience. We're already seeing that on some reefs on the Great Barrier Reef, particularly the inshore and the mid-shelf reefs, where algae has become the dominant kind of life form. And once the algae settles in, it's really hard to get rid of it. And that's what's happened around the world where, you know, local communities have used dynamite fishing, for instance, to kind of harvest their coral reefs. The algae moves in straight after. And then when the coral spawns from neighboring regions, the little spawn can't settle anywhere. And even if they do, they get out competed very, very quickly by the fast growing algae. So there's that real phase shift in having either a coral reef or an algal-dominated reef. And so that's a really scary prospect. And as I said, in diving in the last couple of years up in the far north in particular, where the coral mortality has been high, we are seeing those algal-dominated reefs start to take place.
So what can people do, Dean? What people are listening to this and they're thinking, well, I've never even seen the Great Barrier Reef, because we know that tourism is not seen as one of the threats to the reef, that in fact the benefits of tourism far outweigh the sort of negative aspects of getting people out there. But if people can't get there, and at the moment of course people can't travel anyway, what can they really do to help or to ensure the future of our coral reefs?
It's a really good question. It's one that I get asked almost daily, and I think my response changes almost every time. And you know, this time I think what we're seeing in our behavioral shift in response to COVID-19, this dramatic response to an immediate threat, is kind of what we've needed in the environmental space for a long, long time. And you know what? It's showing us that we can do it, that life, you know, is going to have to change a little bit, but we can get on with our jobs and do things. We don't have to travel as much. You know, we're doing a podcast now from a remote location as opposed to me coming to Sydney. You know, these things are all possible. And that's the kind of shift that we need. While we're doing everything that we can on the ground on the Great Barrier Reef, that Great Barrier Reef legacy, we need the whole world to respond to this climate change issue. And it's funny because, you know, we trust the science with COVID-19. We trust the science of the numbers that are coming out with the, you know, trying to flatten the curve with the vaccine hopefully going to be produced. But, you know, there's still a lot of mistrust in the science in terms of climate change. And I think, you know, it's you know, a bit... ironic to be able to pick and choose, you know, which
look,
sides you want to
address. It's been an interesting, well, interesting is to put it mildly, but certainly it has showed us that we can, I mean, we've been forced to completely change our lives over the last few weeks. And as you say, we're trusting in the scientists. We're not arguing with them because, you know, our lives are we're all personally affected and personally immediately in danger from this virus. So it does give us hope for the future in terms of being able to respond to other emergencies that are maybe not so obvious and maybe don't affect us as directly as we see COVID-19 affecting us. But, well, look, it's great to hear from you, Dean, about that this year's beaching event may not be as bad as the one 2 years ago. And you know, we wait and see to see what actually is the upshot of that when people can get back out there. But we're very proud of the work you do. Australian Geographic is a media partner for Great Barrier Reef Legacy. So, you know, we do whatever we can to help you communicate your message. And we appreciate also the fact that you get citizen scientists out onto the reef. So as well as getting scientists out there, you get lay people out there and they can also learn and become ambassadors for the work that you do.
Absolutely. And look, we love working with Australian Geographic and we have a motto here at Great Barrier Reef Legacy and it's only together there are no barriers too great to save our reefs. And look, that could not be more true right now. We all need to work together and, you know, we're part of a big team, a big global community that is facing another global crisis, which is climate change. It's a long-term one, but we've got to come to the challenge. And I really think we can do it. I think we can.
I love your belief and your enthusiasm. And it's a great message. So I'd like to say thank you to you, Dean, for joining us on Talking Australia today.
My absolute pleasure, Chrissy. Thank you so much.
That's it for today's episode of Talking Australia with Dr. Dean Miller. If you have any questions or comments, feel free to reach out. Write us an email at podcast@australiangeographic.com or find us on Instagram @AustralianGeographic. And if you go to australiangeographic.com.au/talkingaustralia, you'll find special offers for our listeners, including 10% off all products purchased in our e-store. So don't wait and go to australiangeographic.com.au/talkingaustralia. Also, make sure to subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts from, so you'll never miss an episode. Thanks for listening. Until next time.